Thank you, Ephraim, and thank you very much to the organisers of this conference for inviting me to speak in this session. It truly is an honour to be included in this roster of speakers. The topic for this session is a broad one. How do we support growth? As the extended form of the topic indicates, there are many considerations that need to be taken into account, and Ephraim touched on a few of them. In the time available, I can only do justice to a few of those considerations. And so in these opening remarks, I'd like to focus on the issue of the time horizon. The question of how public policy can support growth depends in part on whether we're talking about the short run or the long run. In the short run, supporting growth implies a role for macroeconomic policy, both fiscal and monetary. Australia has achieved its record of economic expansion in part because macroeconomic policy has, by design, supported growth when needed. This has helped us avoid the serious downturns that can do so much damage even long after they have ended. In Australia, the role played by macro policy is informed by long-standing frameworks that govern its conduct. In the case of monetary policy, that framework is the medium-term inflation target that was adopted a quarter century ago. This framework inherently points policy in the direction of supporting growth when that is needed, because demand would otherwise be insufficient. Of course, there are other considerations, including debt and asset prices, as highlighted in the session title. But the bank's financial stability review will be released tomorrow, and it will cover those issues in far more detail than is possible in the time available today. The basic message for policy is still to support demand when it would otherwise be insufficient to absorb spare capacity. Spare capacity in the economy, as there has been in recent years, tends to put downward pressure on inflation. To avoid inflation getting too low, monetary policy therefore needs to be set at an expansionary level, supporting growth so that inflation either does not depart too far from target or returns to target in cases where it has already moved. That's how an inflation target works. And it would do so even if the Reserve Bank's legislated mandate was expressed solely in terms of price stability. But the mandate in our Act also encompasses full employment and the welfare of the Australian people. These things are not in conflict with the inflation target. Rather, they inform how the inflation targeting regime operates day to day. They are relevant to the choices made about how quickly to return to target. The role of an inflation targeting regime for monetary policy in supporting growth can be well illustrated by the events in the Australian economy over the past decade or so. During the build phase of the mining investment boom, there was a great call on Australia's production capacity to get all those new mines built. This meant that, unlike many other countries, Australia reached a point of having little spare capacity quite soon after the global financial crisis peaked. So there was a period where it was appropriate to set the cash rate a bit higher than the levels it reached in the immediate aftermath of the crisis. Since the peak of the mining boom, though, it has been appropriate to cushion the drag on growth as the terms of trade and mining investment declined. That is one of the reasons why monetary policy has been set to support growth in recent years. We expect mining investment to bottom out in coming quarters as the last of the large LNG expansion projects completes. After that, it will probably increase a little as resource firms invest to maintain their production capacity at current levels. The scale of that sustaining investment is nothing like that of the boom of the past decade or so, though. The important point is that mining investment will no longer be dragging on growth. While there's spare capacity remaining, it's important for policy to support above-trend growth and work that spare capacity down. This raises the question of what trend might be and how we would know. Just waiting until you see wages growth or inflation pick up would leave policymakers in the dark about how quickly they are moving towards their goals, or even if they're doing so at all. Instead, people use a range of different rules of thumb to assess how growth is tracking relative to trend or potential growth, as it's sometimes called. Some of these rules of thumb are trickier to use in practice than others. For example, some estimates hinge on an estimate of feasible productivity growth. But these will be subject to the risks that historical relationships no longer apply, or that productivity, which is not directly observable but must be inferred, is just plain mismeasured for a while. A measure of trend constructed in this way is okay to use as a cross-check, but I wouldn't want to rely on it as my only guide. The labour market is, by contrast, a source of pragmatic and accessible signals of where growth is relative to trend. If employment is growing faster than the working age population and the unemployment rate is trending down, those are pretty good signs that the economy is running faster than trend. It can take a while for spare capacity to be absorbed. Therefore, policy settings might need to be expansionary for a number of years. So it is natural to want to ask whether extended periods of expansionary monetary policy might lead to unintended consequences. The consequences for asset prices and financial stability have been dealt with at length elsewhere, including in the financial stability, as I have already mentioned. Another aspect of expansionary policy that has raised concerns in some quarters is the distributional effect. And other central banks have looked into this. It's understandable that they would want to do that because they had set interest rates at much lower levels than seen in Australia, and in some cases they expanded their balance sheets with asset purchases. The findings of that research is that the first order effect of expansionary monetary policy is to put more people in jobs who wouldn't otherwise have had one. This tends to benefit households at the lower end of the income distribution more than those whose incomes are already high. For wealth, there are a number of effects that offset one another, so the net effect on summary measures of the wealth distribution tend to be small. While lower interest rates and asset purchases do tend to support asset prices, and higher equity prices tend to benefit higher wealth households, higher housing prices tend to have the largest effects on households in the middle of the wealth distribution. The effect of asset price increases are also greatest for people with a bit of leverage against their asset holdings. They tend not to be the people with the highest wealth. So in the short run, the answer is clear. It is the job of macro policy to support growth by encouraging sufficient demand to employ our nation's productive resources. But this leaves open the bigger question of how we ensure our living standards continue to increase in the longer run. That is not so much an issue of helping the economy grow faster than trend when there is spare capacity. Rather, it is a separate question of how fast trend can be. Having low and stable inflation is helpful for that because it creates a more predictable investment climate. But beyond that effect, monetary policy doesn't have much effect on the feasible trend rate of growth. There are many drivers of long-run productivity growth, but monetary policy would be way down that long list. Its role is more in the short run than in the long run. Of course, there could be synergies and linkages between the short run and the long run if there is path dependence. If short-run prosperity helps create the conditions for even more long-run prosperity, that is even more reason to ensure that policy supports growth. We're seeing an example of this in Japan at the moment. There, unemployment is so low and the labour market is so tight that firms are investing rapidly in labour-saving technology, and that will boost the productivity in the longer run. Contrast that with the productivity malaise that can set in following a period of contraction or stagnation. People's skills atrophy, or they're assumed to, through lack of use. Firms don't invest to expand production when sales aren't growing. And a kind of scarcity mentality can take hold where risks are not taken and opportunities are missed. Scarcity mentality is all about hunkering down and defending what you have. So it's easy to see how that could get in the way of the processes needed to support growth in the long run. Firms might become less willing to innovate and invest in case the new venture doesn't pan out. People might become less willing to switch jobs in case the new role isn't really better than the old one. But if living standards are to rise, it needs to be possible to produce more with the same resources. The good news is that that means better jobs at better firms. But getting there requires making changes and taking risks. It also requires firms to become better, more productive firms, so they can offer those better, higher paying jobs. And it requires workers to have the confidence to take those jobs rather than always stick with what they have. For this reason, it is significant that job turnover is not particularly high in Australia at present, and that average tenure in a job has been rising. It's worth considering what a productive firm looks like, because not all firms are the same. Some of the latest research on growth highlights the role of differences between firms in creating prosperity. The evidence, both in Australia and abroad, is that productivity varies widely across firms, even within the same narrowly defined industry. Sometimes 6 or 7 times difference between the most productive firms and the productivity of the average firm. It's an extraordinary figure. Firms that are highly productive, the so-called superstar firms, tend to grow faster, grow employment faster, and pay better than firms that are a long way from the frontier of productivity. So the data do suggest that better firms do offer better jobs. But there is a concern here. Because these superstar firms are more productive than average, they gain market share at the expense of less productive competitors. The leading firms could start moving further and further ahead of the pack. The firms that lag would then find it harder and harder to catch up. The result could be that markets become more concentrated. The market leader begins to reap monopoly profits, and that isn't good for consumers, and it might not be good for long-run innovation and welfare. The question is, must laggard firms always lag? Could they instead catch up to today's superstars? Well, it depends what determines which firms lead and which firms lag. Now, perhaps this dispersion has something to do with the distribution of management ability. If so, it's not set in concrete, either at the firm level or more generally, although I do acknowledge the difficulties in both measuring and improving that. Another reason for the dispersion in productivity between firms might be that lagging firms are not adopting latest technologies in the way that the superstars are. Whether this is a universal pattern or something specific to current conditions is not yet known. It is also not yet settled whether this pattern applies in Australia. The existing research focused on other countries. But if this superstar pattern has instead only arisen recently, it could be something to do with the nature of current technological developments and their ease of adoption. While some observers have dubbed the current technological wave a fourth industrial revolution, innovations like machine learning and artificial intelligence seem to have a very different character to previous general-purpose technologies. Those prior waves of innovation in general-purpose technologies, such as the Industrial Revolution, electricity, and the previous computing revolution, all had a democratising character, in the sense that the new technology could be operated by less skilled workers than the technology it replaced. Now, this wasn't always benign, as the child factory workers who replaced artisan weavers during the Industrial Revolution could attest, but it did set these technologies up for widespread adoption. The most recent technological wave seems to have a different character, so it might not be so pervasive in the end. Using machine learning and other emerging techniques to automate routine business processes seems to involve specialist skills and, often, PhD-level training in statistics and computer science to do it well. These skills are much rarer and take longer to develop than those required for the jobs that are thereby replaced. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible, but it could take a long time. If leading-edge technologies are currently unusually costly or difficult to adopt, they become a kind of barrier to entry, protecting the firms that are already using those technologies. In that sense, they're a particular case of the more general barriers to entry that advantage incumbent firms and industries over challengers. Now, that is a concern, because contestability of markets is another essential element for long-run growth and prosperity. Laggard firms will never catch up and will never become those better firms offering better jobs if they have no chance of contesting the market or fully competing within it. And if incumbents never face rivals, they are more likely to become complacent. Innovation could slow down, and growth in living standards with it. All of this comes back to the question of where growth comes from. And the answer is, it comes from all of us. Growth is not something that is bestowed upon a nation by external forces. And though domestic institutions matter, nor is growth in the long run something that governments can bestow upon society. Instead, it's about the myriad of individual decisions within firms and other organisations to find better ways of doing things. An important question is how we as a society support and enable those decisions. But more important is whether we actually make them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, David Uren from The Australian. A question for Lucy Ellis. You spoke about the impact of market concentration on innovation, monopoly profits, perhaps potentially leading to a level of complacency. I'm wondering whether in the Reserve Bank's thinking about market concentration, there are concerns that it may affect the transmission of monetary policy if markets are not working as smoothly as perhaps they might.
Thanks, David. It's an interesting question. The role of market concentration and other aspects of the distribution across firms is something that we're taking a great interest now. We have some people working on the Blade database that people now have access to through the Australian Bureau of Statistics, which is an excellent initiative, and we'll be able to answer a lot more policy questions using that database that previously were impossible to answer. I think our focus there is not so much on could it impede the monetary transmission mechanism, but simply understanding pricing dynamics and understanding investment dynamics. It's not necessarily from the perspective that we think it might impede the transmission mechanism of monetary policy. It's more about understanding what it means for pricing dynamics, investment and productivity growth.
Roscano, University of Melbourne. A question for Lucy or Ephraim. You both drew attention to the effects on the distribution of wealth of low policy interest rates, easy monetary policy. What would be the consequences of long-term interest rates being permanently low? And I draw attention to the big decline in real interest rates in long-term markets in the last 38 years, accelerated in the last 8, and the fact that real rates, indexed bond rates in the United States, remain not very much above zero, even while we have the United States administration running by far the biggest budget deficit at this stage of the cycle in peacetime in history.
Okay. Thanks. It's an important question. There are two parts to it. One is, what's the consequences of low rates for a very long time? And it really depends on why rates are lower. One of the things that has come out of the research over recent times is that the neutral rate, the rate of interest that balances supply and demand of savings at stable inflation and full employment, the sort of the equilibrium, if you like, has come down. There are reasons for that. Some of that's about risk appetite, and that could change. Some of it's about the fact that we went from being high inflation economies to low inflation economies, and so there was sort of a risk premium around that as well, and that's come out. Some of it's about demographics. So these are things that staff at the bank and other places have looked at, and it does seem like the neutral rate, the neutral real rate, has come down a bit, and that's a reasonably comfortable statement to make about the long run. And of course, that's a separate consideration from what I was talking about in my remarks around, you know, the times that you need to have rates low to actually stimulate the economy and run it a little bit above trend. The second part of your question related to, well, how compatible is that with what's going on in macroeconomic developments in some other countries? And you're absolutely right. It is extremely unusual to have a large fiscal stimulus at a time of strong growth and almost full employment. And we really don't quite know what that's going to do, but it can be reasonably anticipated that that's going to be quite inflationary for the United States. And it is the case that at present, markets are pricing in strong growth, very low interest rates, but no pickup in inflation. And so the question is a shoe going to drop there? And I think that's a configuration of pricing that does seem hard to square with what is going on. But it is quite specific to the US more so than, say, here, and the configuration of interest rates here.
Yeah, if I may, Lucy, some more detail perhaps on the international research that you guys surveyed in respect of the impact of low rates on the wealth distribution was particularly, I thought, what Ross was looking for. Could you perhaps just enlighten us a little more with some of the detail there?
Sure. So this was some research that was presented to the board recently. And as I mentioned in my remarks, this is, again, more of a story about other countries than Australia because, firstly, other countries did do asset purchases and did boost their... central banks did boost their balance sheets in a way that wasn't necessary here, in the same way that interest rates didn't have to get as low as they did here. But the findings of that research is that, you know, there are a number of different effects on the wealth distribution from having low rates or at doing asset purchases. Doing asset purchases does tend to boost wealth inequality a bit more than just having low rates. But it really depends on what the wealth distribution looks like, what the asset allocation looks like, and the specifics of the program. So there's not a clear-cut message out of any of this. But one thing that I would mention, we just were talking about superannuation earlier, of course, you know, one of the reasons why asset purchases and low interest rates are said to boost wealth inequality is because it boosts equity prices, and generally higher wealth people are the ones who own the equities. Well, in Australia, we all own the equities through our compulsory super. The superannuation system in Australia is very long equities relative to sort of pension funds in a lot of other countries that are more structured around a defined benefit framework. And so, which tend to be more in fixed interest. These are much more long equity. And so that actually does benefit everyone who's got superannuation. And so in some sense, the first order question around wealth inequality in the Australian context is, are there people who don't have sufficient access to super because of, you know, gaps in their working history and so forth? And I think that's the first order question for Australia.
Thank you. So there's a question there and then a question over there.
G'day, Michael Rodden from The Australian here. I wouldn't mind if Karen just responded to the best in show comments that Chris made just before, and whether you're going to revisit the best in show list for the final report, if you can talk about that. And then broader for the other panel members, Lucy got me thinking about innovation and business, and we've seen that the government's bringing forward its small business tax cuts. Innovation doesn't really happen that much in small business. So I'm just wondering if there's any better way to spend this money and what the panel members' thoughts are on how that money is being spent.
So just on best in show, that the wonderful beauty of the Productivity Commission's process is that we put out a draft report after doing a lot of analysis and consultation. People can tell us what we got right, what we got wrong, and what we missed altogether. Fortunately, with super, we've been working in this space for 2.5 years, so we didn't miss too much. But there are areas of judgment in getting the public policy architecture right in the super system going forward and recognising where we are today. So I guess, Michael, all I can really say is that we, like Darwinian man, do evolve in our process. So our draft report was were our views at that time. We'll now look at drawing upon the 137 submissions, the 120 people that we heard from in our public hearings, and sort of refine and polish those recommendations for government, but also very mindful of the point that Chris made, that, you know, government of the day will have three very important reports in front of them. They'll have the Commission's Financial System Inquiry report, they'll have a superannuation, the final chapter of superannuation report, and then the Financial Services Royal Commission. And I have to say, it's not very often, indeed, I think this is a once-in-a-lifetime for me in a public policy sense, to have planets align where you've had the bookends of a Productivity Commission report on the financial system, a Productivity Commission report on super, looking at the public policy architecture and looking at the evidence base, all of that feeding into and informing a Royal Commission. We can see from, you know, the very careful narrative and commentary both of Michael Hodge QC and indeed Commissioner Hayne in his interim report that they have benefited from the work and the heavy lifting that we've done in an analytical sense to inform their endeavour, and likewise our endeavour will be informed by theirs. So the hearings on super, and indeed the last 2 weeks in November where there's going to be hearings on the public policy aspects, we're going to be watching that very closely before we finalise our report. So it is a very unique constellation of planets that I don't think we'll ever see again, and hopefully that just makes for better policy for the government of the day in considering all of those reports.
Thank you.
There was another question that, yes. So, and thank you for posing two questions and giving me a chance to think about how to reply. The question about tax breaks for small business, when different tax policies have different objectives. And one thing, we've recently published some research by some colleagues at the bank that showed that some of the tax measures that were put through in the GFC were very important in boosting investment and basically, you know, continuing business activity through that period. So it may be that, you know, the intent is not specifically to stimulate innovation. I'd firstly make the point that productivity isn't just about innovating in the sense of you discovering new. It's also about being a fast follower. I talked about the gap between the most productive and the average firm across industries, which can be very large. And that's really not necessarily about you discovering something new. It's also about you making the best use of what's already available and adopting the technologies that are already available. And so one of the things in this discussion around the dispersion of productivity across firms is not actually being at the technological frontier of what's already there. Some of the data in Australia on this, you know, we are seeing firms adopting cloud computing relatively rapidly. So that's one thing that, you know, is a thing that's available and people are adopting. But things like automation, so cloud computing allows you to reduce your costs because you don't have to run your own servers. But automation is the thing that can increase your productivity. And in particular, for a lot of automation of physical equipment can be very advantageous for improving your worker health and safety outcomes. Those are things that you don't necessarily see small businesses doing the way they're doing with cloud computing. The automation is much more something we're seeing in large firms. And so this then comes to this idea of, you know, are people adopting technology? What are the sort of things that they're adopting? And is there a bit of a gap there? There is an issue around innovation around the world. Innovation is hard. One thing I find quite informative is some work that a colleague has done looking at all the patents that are cited and registered in Australia. In Australia, we have some fantastic research being done out of our universities, out of CSIRO and other sort of non-profit, you know, third sector research. But in terms of private sector firms, one of our biggest producers of patents is Aristocrat poker machines. So, you know, there is a genuine question in Australia about the level of innovation the level of innovation across the private sector, not only in terms of discovering something new, but also about whether people are being fast followers. Mm.